Welcome to the Fidelity Bank PLC H1 2016 investor call. Your speaker for today is Nnamdi Okonkwo. There'll be a question and answer session at the end of the call. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Nnamdi Okonkwo, the Managing Director of Fidelity Bank. I'd like to welcome you to this conference call. Our results that we're about to discuss reflect the. Okay, first of all, let me introduce my colleagues here. I have with me Executive Director, Corporate Banking, Yeye Adegbegba. I have the Chief Operations and Information Officer, Bola Joshua. I have the Chief Risk Officer here, Kevin Ugwuoke. I have our Treasurer, Chineze Osakwe. I have the Investor Relations Officer, Sam Obioha. You're welcome. So, like I was saying, our results reflect the slowdown in business, which of course is occasioned by lower government revenues, principally driven by the drop in oil prices, lower interest regime, rising inflation, lower consumer disposable income, impact of currency devaluation. Now, the weaker macroeconomic environment is already reflected in the lower profitability numbers in the H1 results of some of the listed companies in the cement, healthcare, power, FMCG, oil services, and so on. But as a bank, which is also active in some of these sectors, we have proactively increased our provision in anticipation of current or future headwinds. Now, over the last 2 years, we have driven our PBT through a combination of increasing the volume of our earning assets and significantly improving our NIM due to the pressure on fee income lines from the revised bankers tariff and, of course, FX restrictions. However, in Q1 2016, we had the decline in our yield on earning assets outpacing decline in our funding cost, which impacted our net interest revenue. The decline in yields was a combination of lower yields in liquid assets, which are treasury bills, bonds, and placements, and a reduction in lending rates driven by the CRR reduction in Q4 of 2015. We had earlier guided during our last call that we believed the yield curve was abnormal, with government securities delivering yields below the inflation rate. And we thereby decided to play at the short end to be able to take advantage of repricing our earning assets once the yield curve normalized. That decision impacted our income on liquid assets, which declined in H1, but should be positive for us in H2 as we move into a higher interest rate environment. Also, lending rates declined as NIBOR rates dropped by over 4%, thereby reducing the lending rates on our NIBOR-linked loans in corporate banking. And we also reduced lending rates on our high-end commercial and consumer loans customers. Okay, so our key performance highlights. Net interest income improved by 17% to 26.8 billion. This is driven by a 10% expansion in our earning assets. Average yield on earning assets declined 2% to 11.8%. We took a significant revenue hit from the FX trading restrictions and significantly reduced FX liquidity in the interbank market, as our FX-related income declined by 4.2 billion naira in H1. E-banking income improved to 5.9 billion. And this is a growth of 279% year-on-year. On deposits, we grew by 7.8% or 60.3 billion naira from December 2015 with a 40% devaluation of the naira accounting for 25.6 billion out of this 60.3 billion. Savings deposits grew by 15.9% from the 2015 closing figures. And this is a result of our continued retail banking drive. Of course, that has also reflected in our cost of deposits. Low-cost deposits now account for almost 72% of our total deposits. On risk assets, we grew by 23% or 132.9 billion from the December 2015 figures, with 40% devaluation of the naira accounting for 15% of this figure, or equivalent of 89.6 billion of our loan growth. Foreign currency loans now constitute 43.7% of our total loans. This is up from 38.1% in Q1 2016, of course due to currency devaluation. Our organic loan growth was 7.4%, principally driven by on-lending facilities to the public sector, mainly the bailout funds. Cost of risk, well, expectedly increased. It spiked up to 1.4% in H1 due to 4 billion impairment charge taken in Q1 2016. We have taken a very prudent view of the impact of the currency devaluation, tougher operating environment, and declining consumer disposable income on selected sectors of our loan portfolio. And so we're a bit more bullish in taking impairment charges this H1 than would have been. Now, cost of risk, cost of risk at 1.4%, and our provision numbers for H1 have already surpassed the normalized provision from business operations in the entire 2015, where our cost of risk closed at about 1%. Though our NPL ratio declined to 3.4%, but this was largely due to the growth in loan book. We have maintained a more conservative approach going forward and have raised our cost of risk guidance from 1% to a ceiling of 1.5%, while focusing on keeping our NPL ratio below 5%. Our other regulatory ratios, liquidity ratio, capital adequacy ratio, remained above the set thresholds, though capital adequacy ratio declined to 16.4%, principally driven by the growth in our loan book and other earning assets. While costs increased by 10% year-on-year, it declined by 2% in Q2 of 2016. This gives us increased confidence to drive our cost optimization initiatives, and we are looking forward towards even more stringent cost optimization drive this second half of the year. Okay, we guided on reducing our operating expenses by 5% in 2016 financial year. However, due to the currency devaluation and rising inflation, we have now revised this downwards to 2.5%. This is against the 5% we had originally guided for. Okay, on some corporate initiatives we are driving, we completed the upgrade of our core banking system from Finaco 7 to Finaco 10, and that was done successfully, and we migrated to the new system on July 4, 2016. That migration was done with minimal disruptions of our operations. Indeed, customers hardly noticed that a transition happened. So that was good news for us because it didn't really disrupt business. We also upgraded our instant banking platform in line with the Finaco 10 upgrade. And we now have a menu-driven platform where customers no longer need to remember their short codes and now comes more secured with a PIN. Our new instant banking platform actually delivers the same internet banking experience for customers without the need for them to have data on their phones. We believe the upgrade in our technology and payment platforms will significantly help to reduce our operating operational costs to serve while boosting transactional gain income. So over 72% of all our transactions are now done on our electronic channels, with 28% done in the branches. So as we continue to migrate, we actually look forward to reducing the number of hands that we use in the banking hall and channel those to business development activities in the bank. Okay, so our target is to achieve electronic migration of about 80% in the short term. On customer acquisition, well, that one continues to grow. We have now crossed 3.5 million customers mark at the end of June 2016. This increased customer acquisition and increased adoption of electronic products helped to drive the increase in our retail deposit base, as reflected in the growth in savings and demand deposits. So we are pleased with the increased cross-selling of our electronic products, especially this instant banking, which is really catching on, as well as our online banking retail services products. This increased adoption, coupled with rapidly growing customer velocity on our alternate channel, has been a key driver of the growth in our e-banking fees, as reflected in the numbers. So thank you for your attention. At this stage, I'll hand over to our Chief Operations and Information Officer, Bolahan, who will take us through the detailed presentation. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Bola. I'll start from slide 4, which speaks about the operating environment. Inflation rate is still very high at about 16.5%. We think when the GDP numbers are released later this month by NBS, it will officially confirm that the country is in a recession. Reserves are still very low at about $26.2 billion. But we think some of the reforms that have been driven by the government in Q2, especially the deregulation of the downstream, the FX liberalization, and then the implementation of the budget, should improve economic activities in H2. More banking industry specifics, MPC increased the MPR rate to 14% at the July meeting. That inches up the price of the cost of savings deposit to 4.2, because that's tied to the MPR rate. The Naira has seen about a 50% devaluation as we currently speak. There's still a demand pressures on the currency, and liquidity is still a challenge. But we think the currency devaluation and, you know, the lower GDP projections poses some increased risk on the credit portfolio of the banking industry. Slide 5 just speaks about an overview of Fidelity, established in 1987. We have about 400,000 shareholders. Capital adequacy is about 16.4%. We have branches in all the states of the Federation and the FCT. We focus on the SME, niche segment in corporate banking, and then we have a rapidly evolving retail banking business that is driven by the electronic platforms. You just see the distribution of our branch network and then our electronic banking distribution. So we currently have about 235 offices, 3.5 million customers, and BB rating. On slide 7 is just our key performance highlights for H1. Interest income was up 2%. Fee income was down. The drop in fee income was principally driven by the other income line and FX income line. The other income line also included a dividend income from our equity investment. The net interest margin was 6.5%. This is the first quarter we've had a drop in NIM in about the last three quarters. We closed last year with 6.9%. And then PBT was down 35%, which I'll explain in the next slide. Our cost of risk, 1.4%. We significantly increased our provisioning numbers between Q1 and Q2. It went up by about 500%. We were extremely conservative going forward, especially with our exposures from the trade finance perspective. Our coverage ratio is above 100% because of the increased provisioning, and the FCY loans are now about 43.7% of the loan book. Our capital adequacy ratio is about 16.4%. I'll speak more on capital adequacy when I get to the slide on capital adequacy. Our liquidity ratio is just about 36%. And then loan-to-deposit ratio is 85.7%. If you take out the self-funded on-lending facilities, it will actually be 73%. Slide 8 just speaks to the key causes of the drop in profitability. Profitability was down 35%, largely due to an increase in provisioning year-on-year, and then a 10% growth in the cost line, even though cost came down by 2% in Q2. Interest expense declined, understandably because we're in a lower interest rate regime and the mix of deposits was better at 72%. That reduced our funding cost from about 6.2% to 4.6%. But NIM still dropped because we had a 2% decline in our average lending rate due to lower yields on our liquid assets and then a reduction in our average lending rate on the risk asset portfolio. Total operating income, you know, was still up 3.6% year on year. We had a net loss on financial instruments of almost 800 million as interest rates were rising. Obviously, most of the instruments we had on the AFS portfolio, by the time we marked it to market, had a negative spread. Business fundamentals are still very strong despite the 40% devaluation of the currency. Liquidity ratio is still 36%, and capital adequacy, the devaluation shaved off roughly 2% of our capital adequacy ratio. Combination of an increase in our total assets and then absolute growth in the loan book. Slide 9 just shows a year-on-year comparison of all the key lines. You notice that FX income is down 4.2 billion. Over the last few quarters, we've sort of been offsetting that, tried to offset that with the growth in the electronic banking income, which is driven a lot from international card transactions and then fees on, you know, transfers and payments using our mobile platforms. And then you see total expenses was up 10% year on year. Slide 10 shows the quarterly trend. And by the time you get to the operating income line, you see operating income was up 9.8%. And then we had 800 million net losses on financial instruments. And then impairment was up 3.3 billion on a quarter-on-quarter basis. So those were the key drivers of the drop in profitability. Up until when you get to operating income, you see almost a double-digit growth. On slide 11, it just shows an analysis of our balance sheet. The half year compared to full year 2015, you see a drop in our volume of liquid assets, and then there's also a significant growth in our cash reserve. Because of the increase in cash reserve, one, and then because of the growth in the deposit base. And then you look at our total earning assets was up by about 10% over the last 6 months. Slide 12 just shows a quarter-on-quarter comparison, and not surprisingly, liquid assets are slightly down. Cash is slightly down as we try and optimize the balance sheet. And I see very strong growth on the deposit lines, current accounts, $50 billion. Time deposits were down 37.5. Some of the rates were seen in the market. We had to let go of some of the purchase funds we had. The growth you see in other borrowings is basically from the devaluation of the currency, from the borrowings we have, foreign currency borrowings we have. All lending facilities are basically bailout funds for the state government. And then the growth in debt securities is also from the devaluation, which affects the $300 million euro bonds we have. On slide 14, it just shows a breakdown of the gross earnings into the various components. And when you look at on a year-on-year basis, you see there's a decline in most of the fee income lines. There's a slight growth in interest income on loans by 10%, and then you contrast that with the 23% growth in the loan book, even though a lot of that impact of devaluation only happened in June. Interest income on liquid assets were down 14.5%. Lower yields in one instance, that's one, and then the second is lower absolute volumes. FX income was down 70%, not surprising. E-banking income was up, and then other income was down about 4 billion. And then on a quarter-on-quarter basis, you see a further decline in interest income on liquid assets, and then strong growth in electronic banking income. If you go to slide 15, what we're just showing on this slide is the year-on-year growth in key income lines, and then the graph you have beneath is the quarter-on-quarter growth. So year-on-year, e-banking income was up almost 5.5, and then quarter-on-quarter, it was about 2.2 billion. Interest income on loans was up 3.8 billion year-on-year, but quarter-on-quarter, it was barely 100 million, even though there was strong growth in the loan book. A lot of the repricing that came through towards the end of quarter one fed through into the numbers in, quarter two. And if you recall, during our conference call in April for our full-year results, we spoke about the impact the lower lending rates especially will have on our NIBOR-linked loans, because we're already seeing a drop in, the NIBOR rates. On slide 16, it speaks to our net interest margin, the trend of our net interest margin. It's gone up consecutively for four quarters, and then it went down in June for H1 due to the drop in the average lending rate. Slide 17 speaks to our electronic banking income. We expect, it was basically driven, a lot was driven by international card transactions. We expect that to be a slight drop in this income line in Q3. We had to suspend international card transactions in June because of the volatility in sourcing for foreign exchange for those customers. But we still see a lot of scope for improvement in electronic banking revenues from our other payment platforms, especially our instant banking platform, after the upgrade of the of our core banking business and the upgrade of that instant banking platform. Slide 18 just speaks to operating expenses. The key driver of operating expenses over the period was still our advert cost. We have almost a 12-month horizon to push out the new brand, but what you'll notice is that by Q2, it started coming down. And then slide 19 just looks at our various cost lines and what percentage is staff and CIR. On slide 20, you see a detailed breakdown of all our operating expenses on slide 20, and year-on-year growth for the key lines, and you see that Advent brand is 2.9 billion growth, and then we've got a reduction in a couple of the other lines. And then slide 21 just shows where the growth is coming from on a year-on-year basis. On a year-on-year basis, next line was technology cost, which was up 800 million. That's due to the upgrade we're doing, on the core banking system, upgrade we're doing on some of the electronic banking platforms. But on a quarter-on-quarter basis, you see branding and adverts is down almost 400 million, slight growth in the technology cost, and then decline in some of the other cost lines. And then we lowered our cost reduction target from 5% to 2.5% because of the rising inflation rate and then the currency devaluation. We've got a significant number of our technology costs where we pay the ATS fees, they're priced in dollars. So it has a direct, devaluation has a direct correlation on that cost line. On slide 23, we just look at an analysis of the funding base, and it just shows the year-on-year and quarter-on-quarter growth in the deposit base and the other funding sources. Time deposits were down 86 billion year-on-year. Quarter-on-quarter, it was about 66 billion. And then look at savings deposits, grown about 32 billion from where we ended the year with. On slide 24, just an analysis of the deposit base. You see 25.6 billion of, the graph shows you that 25.6 billion of the deposits came from currency devaluation. And then you see local currency deposits about 741, foreign currency 63, and then devaluation impact 25. You add back to foreign currency, you get roughly 90 billion. So deposit mix is improved to about 72%. Slide 25 just shows retail banking deposits start with the savings deposit from 119 billion to 138 billion, and then you see the drop in the retail assets. That was basically due to the repayment structure for some of the loans we have. So we had massive pay downs in Q1 based on the repayment structure, and then we gradually started to build it up again. Slide 26 just shows liquid assets position, and basically we have more treasury bills than bonds. And then you look at liquidity ratio, it's been fairly flat over the last 6 months, hovering from 36%, 37%, and then 36%. And then loan to deposit ratio, the spike you see in H1, it's basically due to the devaluation of the currency, which grew the loan book by about 90 billion. And then when you look at the loan book includes the self-funded public sector on lending facilities. But the corresponding liabilities that were used to fund these loans are not classified as deposits. They are classified as on lending facilities. If you exclude those assets from the loan book, you will see that the LDR is actually 73%. If you take slide 27 shows a breakdown of our risk asset portfolio, H1 versus 2015, a full year, you'll see growth on a lot of the lines, and most of the lines where you see massive growth, a lot of it is coming from the devaluation impact, oil and gas devaluation impact, manufacturing devaluation impact, the transport, which is basically vessel financing, devaluation impact there too. And then we also have some power loans that are in FCY. You also have the devaluation impact there. And then that led to a 23% growth in the loan book. If you get to slide 28, it just shows you the trend of our loan book over the last five quarters. And if you look at an area like general commerce, we had de-emphasized it consistently because of the FX restrictions. The FX restrictions. The slight growth you also saw there was for some of the customers who, when the CBN was playing the backlog, they debited the banks directly, so we passed debit directly to some of the customers, and that's some of the growth you are seeing there. Slide 29 just shows a quarter-on-quarter growth in each of the sectors of the loan book. And if you looked at Q1, out of the 12 billion net growth in the loan book, you see that most of the sectors recorded a decline, apart from the public sector. And then when you get to Q2, you see a gross loan growth of about 125 billion. If you take the top five sectors there where you see growth, if you take out the government sector, most of the other ones are basically driven by devaluation. So out of this gross loan growth of 125 billion, about 90 billion is basically coming from devaluation of the currency, and then you have about 35 billion that is coming from pure play organic loan growth. And then slide 30 just looks at an analysis of the loan book into different products, and just shows clearly the bit that is coming from the devaluation of the currency. We earlier guided for 5 to 7.5% loan growth. The devaluation alone has given us a growth of almost double what we guided for. Slide 31 shows the breakdown of the NPL portfolio. Declined marginally from 26 billion to 25.1 billion. Areas where you see major declines were in the transport segment. We had a vessel that was out of contract initially, but is now within contract, so that led to that loan being classified back as performing. You see some other segments. There's been some deterioration in some other segments. In our conference call, our 2015 conference call, we spoke about a loan that was challenged in the downstream segment. That has been classified. So you see the downstream segment moving from 262 to 1.4 billion. We had a challenge facility from a telecom infrastructure provider, but invoices have now been paid and that has been cleaned up. So reality is that the NPL decline we see now is mainly driven from a growth in the loan portfolio. We're very conservative going into Q3. Out of the $4 billion that was sold by the government in terms of spot and forward, we accounted for roughly 5%. If you convert that to Naira, it's just under being shy of 60 billion. So we know some of those customers are going to have to, we'll take a hit on some of those customers, because as at the time those transactions were entered into, I don't think anybody looked at a cash conversion cycle that took them up to 280 for the lower end players. Slide 33 is an analysis of the of NPL. There's still some pressure points in the oil and gas, general commerce, consumer portfolio, and trade finance portfolio. We think for the consumer portfolio, for some of the state public sector exposures to state civil servants, which is not very high in our portfolio, but we think that should get better with the devaluation of the currency, where the states generally now have more revenues and with their increased FARC. We expect cost of risk to be below 1.5% by the end of the year. We think NPLs will still go up. We're focused on keeping it below 5%. Capital adequacy, if you looked at the movement in our equity on our financials, we've had $33 billion in non-distributable reserves. What we had in our non-distributable reserves was the gross amount and not the difference between our IFRS provisioning and the NGAAP provisioning. So we basically have a capital buffer there. And if you look at our movement in equity, we basically have a capital buffer there of about $24 billion. We've not factored that into the capital adequacy computation we've done here. And so this capital adequacy computation here gives us a capital adequacy ratio of 16.4%. If we factor that in, we get back to our 18% threshold, and that affects both Tier 1 and overall CAR. So we were very overtly conservative. We have used our entire NGAAP provisioning to reduce and taking it as our end year. So that effectively gives us a Tier 1 equity write-back of about $25 billion, which improves our capital adequacy ratio by at least 200 basis points. From a business segment perspective, about 42% of our revenue still comes from corporate banking, 43% from corporate banking, 22% from Lagos, 15% from the north, and about 20% from the south. Loan mix now is about 64-36. Medium-term target is 60-40. Obviously, devaluation pushed up the corporate banking contribution. On our guidance for the year, net interest margin was slightly behind target. Loan growth were obviously over the target, but from an organic perspective, we were just slightly shy of our target. Deposit growth were on track. CIR were behind target, and then on ROE we were behind target. Thank you, and we'll now take questions.
Thank you very much. We'll now open the lines for questions. To ask a question, please press 0 on your phone's keypad. That's 0 to ask a question and 7 to cancel your question request. That's 0 to ask a question and 7 to cancel your request. Your first question is from Tunde Abidoye. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Neil Abide from EvenQuest. My first question is actually on your cost of risk. Given the issues surrounding militancy in Niger Delta and the production shortages we've seen, don't you see a deterioration in the oil and gas upstream exposure that you have? And don't you see an uptick in your cost of risk for the upstream sector? Secondly, manufacturing sector has the highest concentration of NPLs. Can you tell us what subsectors within manufacturing are responsible for this and what remedial actions you're taking on these exposures? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Tunde. For the upstream sector, if you looked at during my presentation on slide 33, we said our pressure points still exist on the oil and gas, and we're speaking more for the upstream sector there. We know we had some customers who had disruptions to their production volumes because of the NDAs. But that's one of the reasons why we've actually increased our guidance from 1% to slightly shy of 1.5%. But like we've consistently said on our calls, if we have to classify one of the major accounts we have in our upstream segment, we won't be talking of NPLs below 5% again. Because of the size of those exposures, we'll be talking of NPLs not of 10%. For the manufacturing sector, about 85% of the NPLs you see on the manufacturing is for a single client. the exposure to the company, we have an exposure to the company, and there's another bank that also has an exposure to the company. Both banks are basically jointly managing the company with the promoter of the company, is into ethanol production or something. So it's about 85%. About 85% of our manufacturing sector NPL is just to one customer. That's been an NPL with us for a few years. So basically, what we and the other bank are doing is running the company and then trying to get enough cash flows to get the loan paid off.
Next question.
The next question. Thank you. The next question is from Chubike from the DBL. Please go ahead.
Is the line clear?
Yes, we can hear you. Please go ahead.
Fantastic. So this question is about the reliability of the dividend payment annually. So as you know, Fidelity Bank prides itself in annual payments of dividends. I'm just wondering, you know, with the results that you have at the moment, the reliability, you know, will it affect, you know, future dividend payments?
I think we've always guided that dividend payment will be about 30% of profitability for the year. We have not changed that guidance, and we have consistently paid dividend for the last 10 years. We don't think we're going to change that this year.
Thank you. Your next question is from Romac from Exotic. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for the presentation and taking the questions. Just a couple of questions with regards to your NPLs and capital and also your dollar balance sheet. Starting from NPLs, what percentage of your loans have you restructured, specifically from the oil and gas sector? And also with regards to that, I guess the first round of loans that you restructured last year, you've seen, you know, the performance of those loans over the last 12 months. Can you just comment how those loans have performed over the last 12 months? The other thing I noticed is, and you mentioned this, that the loan growth in most of your sectors was largely driven by the devaluation. And within that, we can see this some pretty significant growth coming from the real estate sector, the transport sector, the manufacturing sector. So are we to assume that you are lending in dollars to these sectors? And if you are lending in dollars, can you comment on the receivables for on what currency the receivables of the people you are lending to was and how they will be impacted by the devaluation? My third question is to do with your capital. You mentioned, you know, your capital is about 15.5%, but if you include the statutory reserves, you know, that would increase to about 17.5-18%. But I guess the reason the statutory reserves are there is, you know, you're making provisions in advance, and eventually IFRS provision catches up. So you can't make that assumption that once we include statutory reserves, which are non-distributable, our capital adequacy improves to 17.5%. So can you just comment on your consistently declining capital and if you're intending to raise any capital in the next 12 to 24 months?
Okay. Let me start with the question on capital. You've got the local accounting standards provisioning, the NGAAP provisioning, and then you've got the IFRS provisioning. And when your IFRS provisioning is less than the local accounting standards provisioning, the difference between those figures should be in your non-distributable reserves. Now, what we have always done is to put the total local accounting standards provisioning in our non-distributable reserves rather than the difference between both. And so our total local accounting standards provisioning was about 33 billion, and our IFRS provision was about 25 billion. So in reality, what we should have had in our non-distributable reserves was roughly about 9 billion. But what we had there was about 33 billion. So it serves as a capital buffer for us. And that's why now, if we take $24 billion, which is the difference, which we've actually been told by the regulators that that is how it should actually be treated, that we're basically, being overtly over-conservative. So if we take that $24 billion, it improves our capital adequacy by 2%. So we are not taking out of the non-distributable reserves, which is the difference between the IFRS provisioning and the NGAAP provisioning. We're actually taking the portion we had over-provided for there. Now, on the sectors you spoke about, do we lend to the manufacturing, do we lend foreign currency to the manufacturing sector? There are two sets of people that have been affected by the devaluation. The first set of people are people who have dollar-denominated loans. The second set of people are people who have naira-denominated loans, but we give trade finance loans. Now, when the forwards were being settled, when those loans were given, so if someone had a loan with you, for example, $10 million, and then the loan was at a rate of 200 naira, when the forwards were being settled, the forwards were settled at 280. So automatically, the amount, the naira amount you're going to debit the guy shoots up by about 40%. So I guess I was just trying to clarify. Now, for the transport segment, what you have there, a lot of that is vessel financing, and those are dollar-denominated facilities, and the receivables are also in dollars. What was the first question? Now, in terms of what percentage of our loans have we restructured, I think we've consistently spoken about the restructuring we've done for our upstream oil and gas portfolio. That's where we've had the major restructuring. And if we look at the entire portfolio, it will be close to about 65-70% of the portfolio. For a lot of the loans we've restructured, we've used the base price of about $45. And that was why during our full-year conference call in April, we said at the prices where oil was then, which had significantly gone below that, we said there was the likelihood the lenders were going to come together, because most of those facilities are syndicated facilities and do a restructure.
Thank you. Your next question is from OntoBC. We seem to have lost the speaker. Please hold the line. Your next question is from OntoBC OBK. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I have a few questions. First of all, I'm a little bit confused about the level of FX gains you recorded, because I assume you are long on dollars, so I thought, at least compared to your peers, the amount you recorded FX gain is quite smaller. Maybe you could shed more light as to the reason why it's so. My second question is, what's the level of coverage you have on your foreign currency loans? And if you were to take this coverage to 100%, how much more additional impairment would you have to record? This is in line with CBN's recent circular. Then I would like to know your view on what the net impact would be on the bank in this rising interest rate environment. So would it be a net positive for you or net negative? And then my last question, I would appreciate the breakdown of the sectors that contributed the most of your impairment charges in this half year.
Thank you, Ndubisi. I'll start from, in terms of FX gain, I guess the revaluation gains you get is based on the structure of your balance sheet at the point of the devaluation. We were not that long when you look at a net basis, so that's why we do not have significant revaluation gain. In terms of foreign currency loan coverage, a lot of our foreign currency loans have receivables in foreign currency. So the bulk of our foreign currency loans have receivables in foreign currency. Now, where I think we could have a gap, foreign currency trade loans and those are loans that you've given out. You expect the customer to sell, and then you use the proceeds to buy foreign exchange for the customer to repay the loan. And then in between, the customer got caught up in a devaluation. Now, for the high-end customers, we don't have a problem because they have the capacity to cover up that gap. What you have is the customers that are, you know, for some of the SME customers and all that. And that's why that takes me back to your last question, which is which are the sectors that drove our increased provisioning. One of them is downstream. Another one is a general view of the trade finance portfolio. Remember, for some of these clients, we're still in transition. So some of them have forwards that are going to be, we're going to get our payoff actually in the next 2 months. So what we've done is to proactively look at that portfolio and modeled, put the customers in different buckets and then taking a view of those we think might not be able to cover the currency shortfall and we might not be willing to extend additional facilities to trade out of whatever shortfall they have. A rising interest rate environment, at the beginning of the year, we had said we'd like to stay at the short end of the curve because we felt that the interest rates were abnormally low. We should profit from a rising interest rate environment, but all things being equal, it should be positive for us from an NIM perspective. But at times, you find out that from a funding perspective, the liabilities react faster to an increase in interest rates than the lenders than you can pass on to the borrower. In this instance, we have to be very careful because it's not only about increasing lending rates because MPR has gone up. You also have to look at the customer's business and be sure you're not increasing rates and actually turning that facility into an NPL by increasing the rates. But all things being equal, we should be net positive in a rising interest rate environment because of the structure of our balance sheet.
Thank you. The next question is from Clement Adewuyi. Please go ahead. Your lines are muted. Please go ahead. Your next question is from Adewale Okoriboye. Please go ahead.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you for your presentation. I think first question I want to ask is, what is your net FCY position as a half year 2016? And then secondly, what's the reasons behind the jump we saw in impairment? I don't know if you've explained this earlier. For Q2, and lastly, with regards to the treatment of the non-distributed reserves, can you clarify what you exactly did in Q2? Maybe just go over it again, because I just got into the tail end of the discussion. Thank you. That'll be all.
I earlier spoken on the position. The net position was basically, I'll just say, slightly below $10 million on a net position basis. The second question... I think the second question is you spoke on the impairment. What drove the impairment? The bulk of the impairments were driven by provisions we had to make for our trade finance loans due to the currency devaluation. And then we also had a provision we had to make in the downstream segment. And then just generally looking at some other sectors, we also had to make some forward-looking provisions. In terms of treatment of non-distributable reserves, we had taken our total NGAAP provisions as our non-distributable reserve. But what the requirement actually says is that you should take the difference between your NGAAP provisions and your IFRS provisions to non-distributable reserves. So in non-distributable reserves, we had about $33 billion, which is our total NGAAP provisions. Meanwhile, our IFRS provision is about $25 billion. So the difference between those two, which is about $9 billion, should have been what is in our non-distributable reserves. Now, in calculating the capital adequacy ratio we have on this presentation, we are still using 2015 audited numbers without that adjustment for non-distributable reserves. So basically what I was saying was that, yes, capital adequacy ratio is 16.4%. When we factor that in, capital adequacy ratio will move back to our 18% range of about 18.4%. So that 24 billion, if you take it against our risk, total risk-weighted asset, gives you about 2%. So it basically gives us an additional 2% buffer.
Thank you. The next question is from Shogun Akinwale. Please go ahead.
Hello?
Your lines are muted. Yes, we can hear you. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I have a few questions for you, please. It's on your liability with COFACO, the borrowings from COFACO. As at the year in 2015, you actually emphasized that you're going to actually set to the loan is going to mature by April 2016. But based on your report for June, it actually went up. It wasn't, I want clarification on that. Is it the you agreed to facility, or I really just wanted to clarify that? I want to know if we should expect more impairment based on the circular release by CBN, and how much should we look at for the end of the year? You actually explained that on the impairment. Those are my few questions. I would like clarification, please. Hello?
Yes. Okay. Should we expect more impairment? In terms of absolute numbers, we will still have to take more impairment in terms of absolute numbers. So for H1, impairment at roughly 4.8 billion is about a cost of risk of about 1.4%. Now, what we've guided for is that we don't expect the cost of risk to exceed 1.5% for this year. So if you look at that over the next 6 months, that means we expect to take an additional impairment of roughly close to what we've taken for H1 over H2 at the maximum. Remember, for some of the facilities, we've taken a very conservative view, especially for some of those on the trade portfolio. We don't want to get to the point of where it is when we actually cycle out of the facility, or as the case may be, on cycle out, that we'll now start taking provision. So we're trying to also avoid a scenario where you just see that our provisions for H2 or full year is a very massive spike from what we had in Q3. I think when we released our numbers in 2014, one of the complaints by the analysts was that if you look at our Q3 provisions and you look at our full year provision, there was a massive spike. So what we've tried to do now is to try and take the provisions as we see them proactively. And if you look at our provisions for last year, Q3, if you compare Q3 to Q4, you find out that in Q4, we actually took almost the smallest amount of provisions, excluding the one-off one we took, which was regulatory. On Propaco, I didn't really get the question very well. It's part of our long-term borrowings, but I didn't really get the question you asked on Propaco very well. If you could please repeat the question.
Thank you. We seem to have lost the caller. Can you press 0 on your phone's keypad, please? I have to ask the question again. Thank you. We seem to have lost the speaker. We seem to have lost the caller. Your next question is from Emeka Ononya. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hello. Hello.
Yes, we can hear you. Please go ahead.
Okay, my question is on your high loan to deposit ratio. Looking forward the second half of the year, are you looking at growing your loan book, and what percentage are we looking at? Looking at the capacity you currently have at about over 85%.
Okay, let me clarify. During the presentation, I said, if you look at the loan-to-deposit ratio, yeah, that's the general basic calculation. Included in the loans are self-funded on-lending facilities to the public sector. Now, those facilities, we did not fund it from our own liabilities. We get the liquidity from the central bank, and then we on-lend to the state government. The loans are treated as part of the loan book, but the facilities, when you look at our balance sheet, the liquidity is part of our deposit. So what we said in our presentation was that if you exclude those facilities, our loan-to-deposit ratio, customer-funded loans and customer-funded deposits, you will see is 73%. Now, going back to growing the loan book, which is still above the regulatory threshold of 80%, so it's 73%, so we still have headroom. But going back to growing the loan book, we actually guided the year for 5 to 7.5%. But at H1, we're already on 7.4% organic growth for what we guided. So we do not really think you're going to see any significant growth in our loan book. First, the macro is very challenged. A lot of the sectors and a lot of the clients are challenged. So for us to lend, we have to lend profitably and we have to lend also safely. I think we'll be more concerned the second half of the year in dealing with the inherent risks we see in certain pockets of the portfolio.
Thank you. The next question is from Romak from Exotic. Please go ahead.
Hi. Just as a follow-up, just wanted to find out what your liquidity is on your dollar balance sheet, and I guess this is sort of related to the loans to deposits ratio question. Your loan to deposit ratio on the dollar side is almost 175%. On top of that, when I look at your full year annual report, it seems you've got syndicated loans or multilateral debt of around $165 million maturing this year. So what does that do to your dollar liquidity, and how are you positioning or hedging against that?
During the whole, when it was very difficult to get for customers to get FX to pay for their correspondent banking obligations, one of the things we did was we used our own liquidity to pay off the correspondent banks as the deals mature, and because we did not want to be in default. Now, what we basically have at the time the CDN was coming to clear the backlog is now that when we get these dollars paid in, it now replaces that liquidity that we had used to fund those customers. Like I explained earlier, we are getting about $200 million from the spot and the three forwards that have been done. Now, that liquidity coming in is basically liquidity that is going to replace our own proprietary liquidity we had used to pay off the correspondent banks. And that gives us sufficient room and buffer to pay off any maturing obligations that we have coming in this year.
Okay.
Thank you. The next question is from Ola Ogunsoya. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking the call. I just have two questions. So my first question is on your net FX position. Please, can you verify that amount? I think I heard $10 million, but I just need to confirm. And secondly, if you could please give an update on ITO. So what sort of conversations are you having with the central bank now? Thank you.
Yes, net position was roughly $10 million. On ITO, it's a syndicated facility which we're in with a couple of other lenders, and the syndicate is still engaging. So really, I cannot speak much about it now because there has been no new, recent, or latest development. But I'm sure once the syndicate finalizes, then they'll come out with a joint position. It's not Fidelity can't take a singular position. The position has to be taken by the syndicate, all the syndicate members, because the syndicated facility.
Thank you. The next question is from Clement Adewuyi. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. My question is on the Wando loan, which you took a special 5 5% provision through your P&L as at full year 16. What's the status of the loan? Is it still on watch list? Is it performing, or you will have to classify it as an NPL?
Okay.
Okay. My name is Yeye Adekweba, Corporate Banking Executive Director. On the Oando loan, what has happened is that all the lenders to Oando came together to do a regulator-led restructure of the Oando facilities. This has been done. A lot of the receivables that should have come in at that time, they are coming in, and they are being applied to pay down the loans. The syndicates have also gone back to the regulator to do a joint presentation to the regulator on this. So everything is okay now, and we're expecting the regulators to come back to us on the impairment.
Thank you. Your next question is from James. Please go ahead.
Hello, this is Amadi Tenebera from First Asset Management. I just wanted to know how you intend to repay the $300 million Eurobond that matures in May 2018. Is there a sinking fund to ensure funds are available to repay investors?
Okay, $300 million maturing in May 2018. That's a long time from a Nigerian banking industry perspective. I think we've structured the maturity profile and the liquidity of our foreign currency balance sheet to deal with all the obligations we have maturing as they come. So I just gave an example of the ones we have maturing this year. The loans we funded with the Eurobond and the receivables we get from them, we do not think there will be an issue with it. We've made payments of over $125 million also on maturing obligations this year. And I think throughout the FX, where there was FX scarcity, if there was one thing we did as Fidelity Bank, we never defaulted on any of our payment obligations to our foreign correspondent bank. So we'll take that same track record in going through to pay for the Eurobond.
Your next question is from Ola Warikoru. Please go ahead.
Hello. Thank you very much for the presentation. This is Ola Warikoru from SBG Securities. My first question is for the SME sector. What is your outlook on the sector given current economic challenges? Then secondly, on your costs, like we see that, yes, you reduce costs quarter on quarter, but this is quite small compared to peers, and I would like to find out what areas is Fidelity finding it difficult to manage costs. Also, what do you see as the low-hanging fruits in cutting your costs going forward? And then my last question is on your ROE target. What changes do you expect to drive achieving your ROE? Thank you.
For the SME sector, I think for the last two conference calls we've had, we've said we're still very focused on the SME sector, but we just de-emphasize those that are heavily reliant on have import dependencies because of the FX scarcity. So we see a lot of opportunities in some other sectors. For example, those in hospitality have seen increased business because of the lower disposable income and then the pricing of some of the higher end brands. So we're still very much focused on the SME sector. It's just in terms of different plays within each area. On cost, we had a 2% decline quarter on quarter. Yes, in comparison to peers, but if you look at absolute cost numbers and you compare us with peers, we're not significant cost outliers. If you look at absolute cost numbers, I look at the other tier two banks that have released H1 results, I look at total cost numbers. Where we see low-hanging fruits from a cost perspective,
We see some from in terms of full-time employees, not in terms of reduction, but more in terms of using the staff more productively. And like we said, from an electronic banking perspective, we think our CIR is going to be driven by a combination of two things, reducing the absolute cost line and then driving improved productivity and revenues. So for us, something like electronic banking does two things for us. It should help us reduce cost in the branches because we might not need as many people as we need now to serve the customers. And then we push, we have a lot more people actually selling rather than serving. Right now, we've hit 72%. We're targeting electronic transactions to in-branch transactions. We're targeting to hit 80% in the short run. And then from a full-year perspective, we're targeting to have a 2.5% reduction in cost. Early days for us, the devaluation and inflation rate has slightly changed our projections, but we believe if we go the cost, we're also doing a business process optimization with Pricewaterhouse. It's a six-month project. They're reviewing all our processes and basically designing what you call the bank of the future in terms of how our processes should be and automation. That project will, they will conclude that project by the end of November. So we will see some savings this year, but we believe we'll see much more massive savings next year.
There are currently no questions at this time. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for participating. Well, in closing, I'd just like to say we still expect a tougher operating environment in H2, especially given the development in FX market, the higher interest rate, lower GDP numbers, and rising inflation. But for us at Fidelity Bank, our key objectives for the remaining half of the year would be to continue redesigning our systems and processes. Bolanjo just mentioned our business process review that's ongoing. This will enhance service delivery, help our cost optimization initiatives to achieve the guided 2.5% drop in cost-income ratio. We'll also be very focused on proactive risk management in these uncertain times. Now, increased customer adoption and migration to our digital platforms will be another area of focus. We'll continue to increase our retail banking play because we are seeing the numbers and the benefits from what we've done so far, especially the growth in the area of savings and demand deposits. So we remain committed to the continued execution of our medium-term strategy with a focus on improving our operational efficiency and cost to serve in 2016. So on that note, I thank for participating in this call, and we look forward to speaking to you again at the next call. Thank you.
That concludes today's call. Thank you.